Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Brazilian coup edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week the attack on Brussels, and Brazil's pending coup d'etat, when is a coup okay? Let's begin episode 333.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist.
And Matt, your part-time co-host and full-time bipolar perspective on the universe.
Before we start, my apologies for my voice. It's still a bit of a wreck, but the show must go on, so the show shall go on. I should start by pointing out that we had hopes to present a segment a few shows back, but as my loyal listeners know, my voice and I have not been on speaking terms. Let's see if we can get through it this segment this week. I had originally planned to start talking about how the events that had happened in Brussels with the horrible deaths in the airport and subway, and how that these events no longer seem to be rare, that they seem to happen every day. Then I thought about it again, and typical of me, I thought, well, yes and no. It is true that these events are major disasters. The loss of life is horrendous. The sense of fear and terror are palpable. And that it stops every member of that nation, well, to stop and take stock of their world. Is it safe to walk the streets? What must be done to ensure this never happens again? So I had a thought experiment of sorts. Now, I expect to get some blowback on this, but let me postulate something. That we live with this kind of risk, this level of death, this type of unpredictability, every day, and we think nothing about it. We have instituted some basic precautions. We have agencies with limited power to help prevent comparable disasters. In Canada, the agency in charge of preventing my comparable disaster is Transport Canada. Okay, so yes, I am making a practical equivalence to the dangers and risks of terrorist attacks to that of airline fatalities. Now, before you get upset, hear me out. Now, there are some salient differences. After a plane crash, you rarely hear Boeing or Airbus claiming responsibility for the crash. They never say that they caused the crash to protest new fuel taxes or excessive regulations. So the goal of the, quote, perpetrators are very different. But the results, well, last year, 151 people were killed in, quote, accidental plane crashes. In 2014, almost 600 people died. And I say accidental because I'm not including actual terrorist attacks or Malaysian Flight 17, which was maybe perhaps accidentally shot down, but it was definitely not a natural event. Compared to less than 11 deaths in 2014 or 208 in 2015, and 2015 was not actually a very good year, but relatively speaking, we should be more worried about Boeing than ISIS. Okay, so there doesn't really seem to be actually an existential threat to our way of life from terrorism. None. But that said, we need to ask some questions. One of the reflective defenses the Belgian security forces have been stating in their defense is that they just don't have the manpower to keep a tap on all the potential bad guys. That is, they know that there are X number of people who are possible or even likely to be involved in terrorist plots. I hear numbers anywhere from 200 to 500. Let's assume there are only 10. Why 10? Well, who could argue that there's not at least 10 people in a country willing to blow something up? In fact, I bet if you did a survey of Radio Free Thinker hosts and guests, you'd find that there were 10 people willing to blow things up. Well, okay, maybe not. That's for you to decide. But let's start with 10. One suspect, Salah Abdeslam, who was the focus of the recent manhunt that may have triggered the recent Brussels bombing, well, he's believed to have been using about 20 burner phones. And burner phones are phones that are intended to be untraceable. We could pretend they are, but as Snowden showed, they're always listening. But are they? Even if the technology exists, could they actually be listening? Every phone, then, would require an agent to keep tabs on it. So now for every suspect, you need 20 to 30 agents just to keep an eye on the signals intelligence, i.e. phone, internet, maybe possibly a man on the ground. And then you multiply that again for the number of people to analyze the data these operatives are collecting, and how many more to actually act upon what the analysis says. So now you're talking about thousands of people just to keep an eye on these potential threats. And how much money have we spent not only to pay for these personal surveillance, but the other infrastructure needed to maintain the surveillance state? A little side note here. In the past, I've used the term surveillance state in a negative way, sort of a Nazi-esque kind of way. But in this context, I simply mean the part of the state whose job is to provide security info. So don't overthink my meaning here. Back to the point. It seems the Belgian government, or at least its security agencies, are saying that while terrorism is bad, it's only part of their job, and that priorities must be made. For every agent listening in on a terrorist suspect's phone call chat is one agent not tracking down a drug lord, an embezzler, someone kidnapping babies from a hospital. What about the babies? Okay, sorry about that, but you get my point. Priorities must be made. And it seems the security agencies in Belgium are saying that, yes, this is a tragedy, but it's kind of the price we pay for, well, freedom. Sounds nice, but there are more priorities. You have to pick your battles. That said, there does seem to be a lack of coordination in the way that Belgium operates its security agency. So there are lessons to be learned. Ways Belgium could make it less likely such an event would happen in the future without actually reducing freedoms. Then, of course, there are the other elephant in the room. Could it have been prevented? No. And by no, I mean that, and this is not my quote, but it is accurate. The security agencies must be on the ball 100% of the time. While the terrorists, well, to be fair, bank robbers, murderers, or what have you, they need to only be right once, and they win. The thought experiment goes like this, and yes, I'm playing into the hands of every white-ring fascist, but the argument is sound, if not perfect. Let's pretend there are 101 terrorist plots. Of those, the security agency stops 99. One might call that a win, but is it? But when those two are the bombing of the airport and the subway, well, that sounds like a loss. And it's not so much that, well, you can never be 100%. So the real question must be asked is not can we stop terrorism? No, we can't. Even the Nazis had terrorist attacks. Although because they were on our side, we tended to call them partisans or liberation attacks. Terrorism is in the eye of the beholder, but I digress. I said before, the guys who attacked in Paris are evil people and they need to be condemned, so I'm not trying to defend their motives. But once we accept the fact that we will never be completely safe, that there will always be, and I mean always be, terrorist attacks for one cause or another, we're left with the next question. How many is too many? What is their endgame? Matt, do you have any thoughts on that?
Again, I've always been someone who mentions optimism occasionally, and I just want to bring up two facts. One, I disagree in the fact that there can always be terrorists. I believe in some kind of future society, or even a society right now out there that is not us, who actually lives in harmony and peace. So that is one thing that I just wanted to mention. How many is too many? Like you were saying, one can be too many. The real question is, how do we get to that zero point? How do we get to stopping it before it happens or stopping it on their territory? We spoke when it was the live show that I am someone who is not for war, and I'm someone who doesn't want to help any right-wing conversation. But it's hard in this circumstance not to side further right than I would like to go. Not as far as someone like Ted Cruz, who currently said last week that we should be patrolling Muslim areas in the States, which is one thing I didn't interrupt you about. But he's saying that American troops or American or police departments should be patrolling Muslim areas to make sure this kind of attack doesn't happen on American soil. That's horrible. These people are your people. These people live in America. They are usually Americans.
But Matt, if I may interrupt, the people who did the Belgian attacks were Belgians. Right, they were homegrown, for lack of a better word.
Right. So, however, you did point out that there are some lacking in Belgian securities. Right. I would say American security is, unfortunately, the best in the world, or at least some of the best in the world, because they intrude on all these freedoms. Right. We have, as you were mentioning, Snowden and the type of work the NSA can do. They are much more intrusive in terms of their policing. So I think that they're doing a better job on their front, at least. So I agree with you. And one of the things making it so easy for the terrorists is the areas in Belgium. I forget what the actual neighborhood is called. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Molenbeek.
Molenbeek. So this is an area in Belgium which is primarily Muslim, and it is also very poor area, which means that there are negative sentiments, obviously, towards them and also from inside to the outside. So they feel like outsiders because they're treated like outsiders. And this is just ISIS. The fact that ISIS exists is perpetuating this, and that's what ISIS feeds off of. And therefore, what happens is these people who are creating these attacks or people who are siding with them, they are able to hide in places like this. I don't believe places like this or neighborhoods like this exist in America as much. I think you'll find much more areas in the United States that are poor, that are primarily African American or Native American. So and we're not patrolling those areas. So there's reasons why this is happening in Belgium, and that's because of areas like this.
So one might make a parallel to Canada that, and I'm going to put huge scare quotes around this, not to be too provocative, but a lot of the quote terrorist activity in Canada have been actually First Nations in their, well, blocking of roads has been a very popular activity. Not the same in any kind of way.
Yeah, not but terrorist activity.
When you have
activity.
The idea of an isolated community that doesn't feel part of the whole, that these kind of things are much more likely to occur than a more well-integrated group.
Exactly. Those that are more like more supported. Integrated is a really good way to say it as well, but they don't necessarily have to be maybe socially or culturally integrated, but at least accepted more so than they are right now. So
I think the term buy-in is a good word here, that they feel that they are a part of the society, even if they are not identical to everyone in that society. One of the things I think you've touched upon that is, I think, a big difference is that because Canada and the U.S. are a nation of immigrants, we are all sort of from somewhere else, that we integrate others better, not necessarily perfectly. Lord knows there's a history of us screwing it up, but there is this history of integrating different groups into the whole. Whereas Europe, well, Belgium actually is probably not the best example to use because it hasn't existed for more than, I think, 300 years. I think it was in the 1800s, Belgium was kind of created out of whole cloth. But in general, most of the nations of Europe go back 1,000 or longer years where they say, what does it mean to be French? Well, it means 1,000 or 2,000 years of history. And trying to integrate new groups into that is a much different endeavor.
Yeah. And with, especially with Canada, I mean, we were, obviously there's a lot of immigration in the United States, but I think why, just totally offhand or off topic here, but I think why the United States is a lot less integrating is because they fought for their freedom and now they have to fight to, quote unquote, fight to keep it. Right. Whereas we separated democratically, we separated peacefully from queen and country.
And as so any we're civilized now, nation would do.
As a civilized nation would do. We love our American listeners. So, yeah, I completely agree with that. And so it's not to say that it's impossible. I reckon there are. I'm trying to think of countries that are much more accepting of a large multicultural presence. Any listeners out there, email Don if they know of any examples.
Actually, you can email me at info@radiofreethinker.com. Well, actually, so here's another weird thing then, Matt, and what's your take on this, is we have seen, at least at first, and with regards to the Syrian refugees, places like Sweden and Denmark and, you know, Germany saying, yes, we will take as many refugees as you can send us. And then, of course, there's this like, well, okay, maybe not as many, but it seems like these countries, at least on the first step, are very accepting. But on the second step, there's this like, well, wait a minute, let's rethink this a bit. And maybe to answer my question a bit, I have noticed in my study of European history that Europeans are, by and large, a lot better at being, how should we say, generous to foreigners. Right. Again, with regards to refugees, with regards to political dissidents, you know, you go to France. France has had so many people who have been running for their lives from dictatorships around the world. And France will say, come here and we will protect you. We will let you, give you a home while you need it.
But, well, arguably because of what happened to them during World War II.
Well, but, and this is the big but in the room, pardon my ass, is that it is temporary. So refugees are seen to come there temporarily until they can go back. So Europeans are very generous in their, or very gregarious in accepting people temporarily. It's only when those immigrants want to stay that they suddenly become very defensive.
Yeah. And, you know, Germany, or at least Germans in general, I've read, there was an article there saying that they want them to integrate, right, as we were just saying, and they want them to accept the culture. You know, they want them to be part of society, which I can accept. I think that's the right outlook. I don't – obviously, stick with your culture. Be part of your country. I wish I had that. I wish I had my history or a history. But being a part of a country, a part of a social – an economic network that has accepted you is very important, right? It's very, I, being someone who works in customer service, being someone who's out and about talking to people all the time, I'm that kind of person. It's very difficult to come across someone who doesn't want to be Canadian. It's here for whatever reason, but you can tell they don't want to talk to you, tell they don't want to try and talk to you. So I would love to – I'm a very accepting person, very positive person, but I can understand why a country would want a group of people to integrate themselves, you know, be part of that culture.
And there's probably, you know, the catch-22. It's we want you to integrate, but we'll never accept you because you're not already one of us. You know, I mean, like, how does a Muslim – integrate into a Protestant society? right? You know, I mean, there are some things that seem to be a big ask.
Well, I mean, but the thing is, you're saying it's a big ask, but this is, we're not in Ireland here or wherever, right? We're not in an area where, okay, look, saying from Canada, so to speak, religion on a nation level is not that important, right? Like we're saying, oh, you know, you're coming in as a Muslim, you're coming into a Protestant area or whatever. That I kind of disagree with the fact that there's a difficulty there, because when it comes down to it, we're just all people, right? You're coming into it as someone who is a foreigner, who doesn't speak the language, who doesn't understand our customs. So I'm less worried about, you know, what you practice and what you believe, and more about, you know, creating a successful integration process in which you can speak, you know, English eventually, or find an area in which you don't need to, but you are contributing to the society and are open to being a part of the society and not creating an independent nation or area of your own within said nation.
There are so many things I could take off that, like in Richmond, where there are so many Chinese-only signs, but I won't go down that road for the moment. But I will
go down number one road?
Yes, or number three road, whichever one you choose. But there's another confounding factor there, is one of the problems that you have in Molenbeek isn't just that you have a society that is sort of not accepting these different people, but you have elements within the minority who want to agitate, they want to rub salt in the wound, if so to speak, of this difference. They don't want the people to integrate. They want them to remain separate for their own personal ideological interests. And on the other side, you get places like Switzerland, which was going to, I don't think they did, but they were going to ban minarets, right, from their country, because it was an alien thing. And in Holland right now, there is a significant political backlash against anyone who isn't, quote-unquote, proper Dutch. And not that these people are right in any sense of the word, but both sides, there are people willing to make political points for their own personal gain. We can think of Trump and Cruz as great exemplars of these particular inklings. What do you do about that kind of challenge? And you have 30 seconds to solve this world problem.
Sorry, I got a little bit sidetracked here. I just wanted to bring up some numbers. Estimates suggest that in France, like now that we're talking about France, I'll bring up a French number, 18 people per million residents sides with ISIS, whether they become, you know, a fighter or whatever. They support and generally will do something for them, okay? In Belgium, it's 46 per million. That is a substantial jump. Substantial. And one of the reasons is because of that.
Well, and there is an important point to that, too, just to... I think because you're dealing with relativistic numbers, your point holds. But quite often when people say, do you support ISIS? That could mean some very different things to different people. Do you think it's right that the West is bombing Muslims in the Middle East? That might be what you're thinking when you say, yes, I support ISIS, as opposed to some who say, yes, I think the West is a horrible thing and we should do whatever we can to recreate the caliphate, which is a very different sort of take on the question.
Yeah, and Sharia law and whatever have you. Yeah, it's... As we said before, I mean, it's just a shitstorm, right? Like, ultimately, it comes down to there's a lot of factors, but it does come down to there's a lot of more coming out of Belgium than anywhere else, and specifically Brussels because of that. So, anyway, it's a nightmare. It's
well, you know, and of course there are the ironies because they have just recently reopened the airport. They have new restrictions. What is it? First of all, they're basically telling people that, you know, plan on at least 3 hours of going through security checks, that they're actually going to have a pre-check of cars, then they're going to have a pre-check of people in a temporary pre-departure area, and then they're going to have the regular security checks. which essentially has tripled the number of soft targets for terrorists to attack. Because you're going to have lineups in all three of these areas, so you have huge crowds, which is exactly what a terrorist wants, is a large number of innocent people to attack.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is like, how do you... There's no good way around this, right? And this is the thing, is how do you create a secure network, or how do you create the right steps here? And we're, it's just Band-Aid work, right? Right now is, hey, like, let's solve this problem. Let's make sure that this attack doesn't happen again on airports or on planes, which is bad because of the number of people that are getting on the plane other than the people, like you just suggested, that are in the actual lineup who are more at risk here, right? But it's this is the problem we're talking about in terms of the integration. If that can be solved, if we can create a more supportive network for these people, if we can try and bring them into the fold, that is the way to solve these issues, right? World peace, man, you know, daisies and kumbaya and shit. It's bringing people together. That's what it's about. If we can actually get everyone on the same side, and that's the end game.
That, I think, is your utopian dream.
That is my welcome to Harvey Land, where we're all on the same friggin' side.
And I think on the note of kumbaya and shit, that's a good point for us to end this particular segment. We'll be back after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Free Thinker, your fully culturally integrated skeptical radio broadcast on 101.9 FM Vancouver, Canada, Earth. If you have any comment, thoughts, or events you want aired on Radio Free Thinker, send them to info@radiofreethinker.com. You can listen to this show or any of our past shows at radiofreethinker.com. Click on the Listen Now tab. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher. And we are back. This week I thought we would talk about democracy, revolution, and the just and unjustness of the coup d'etat. This was inspired by what is currently going on in Brazil. So what is going on in Brazil? If you tune into the news, you hear about the multiple remarkable crises consuming Brazil, so much so it has actually attracted Western media's attention. Brazil is the world's fifth most populous country and eighth largest economy. Its second largest city, Rio de Janeiro, is the host of this year's Summer Olympics, and it hosted the last World Cup. Also, as with Western media in Canada and especially that of the US, Brazil's media is concentrated in the hands of a few oligarchies. Much of Western media coverage is mimicking the propaganda provided by Brazil's homogenized, oligarch-owned, anti-democracy media outlets, most of it misleading, inaccurate and incomplete, especially for those of us unfamiliar with the country. Brazil is suffering its worst economic crisis in decades. The oil bust that is currently afflicting Alberta, well, imagine that on steroids. Oil represents about 3% of our GDP. In Brazil, it's 13%. Add to this, the Zika epidemic, which is causing widespread despair across northeastern Brazil, and did I mention the Summer Olympics are supposed to start in a couple of months? Along with the protests about the government spending money on PR events like the World Cup and the Olympics. You have at Petrobras, the National Energy Corporation of Brazil, massive and multiple investigations into corruption and graft. These investigations and likely convictions has hobbled the nation and threatens to bring down the current government, democratically or perhaps in other ways. In the midst of all this though, the current government and in particular the president, Dilma Rousseff, are still very popular with the majority of Brazilians, well, a certain segment of Brazilians, let's call them the 90%. I think creative types call this foreshadowing. Even with their support, the once remote prospect of President Dilma Rousseff's impeachment now seems likely. Why? Well, it's called media spin. Remember I mentioned who owns the vast majority of Brazil's media, let's call them the 10%. To be fair, almost every corner of Brazil's political system is under a cloud of scandal, around 60% of its version of parliament is under criminal investigation. So, on the one hand, it is true the Dilma's Workers' Party or PT, is rife with serious corruption, but so is every other party. Now, the view from the Brazilian press, that these increasingly large street protests are described as inspiring mass populist uprising against a corrupt regime, is echoed by Western media outlets. NBC's Chuck Todd is describing the anti-Dilma protests as the people versus the president, something right out of the oligarchic Brazilian media's anti-government playbook. So, who are these protesters? How representative are they of Brazil as a whole, and what might be the real agenda of the 10%? Well, first we need a bit of a history lesson. In 1961, Brazil had the audacity to elect a left-wing government, the first peaceful transition of power to an opposition party in the republic's history. But this was the Cold War. You are either 100% with the US and its vision of capitalism, or you're a commie that needs to be removed. So, in 1964, the country's democratically elected left-wing government was overthrown by a military coup. In the same way the Americans orchestrated regime change in Iran, Chile, and other nations. For the next 21 years in Brazil, the right-wing, pro-American military dictatorship ensured its power with brutal and tyrannical use of violence on its own people. In a Truth and Reconciliation report released in 2011, it came to light that the US and the UK were providing training in torture techniques. Among their victims was Dilma, who was an anti-regime, left-wing guerrilla imprisoned and tortured by the military dictators in the 1970s. Now, of course, not everyone suffered under the dictatorship. For Brazil's oligarchy, the people who owned the factories, resources, and had the money, dictatorships can have a calming effect. There is little change of worker status, the ability of the 10% to maintain their status becomes much easier. Oh, and did I mention there is a racial element to this story? Not surprisingly, the vast majority of this 10% are white folk, who would have been the colonials back in the day. At the time, one of Brazil's leading media outlets, Globo, who is still the major media outlet in Brazil, Globo depicted the 1964 coup as a noble defeat of a corrupt left-wing government. Sound familiar? So, in the 60s and 70s, the elites and the small middle class, also largely white, staved off what they saw as a communist threat, that was also convenient to ensure their socio-economic status. To this day, much like in the US, this class/racial divide is a dominant dynamic. Brazil has one of the highest levels of income inequality. Brazil ranks 12th according to the World Bank Gini Index, a measure of relative inequality in a nation. To put it into context, Mexico is 24th, Russia is 60th, the US is 63rd, and we here in Canada rank 108th. Not bad, Canada, be proud. PT, the current embattled president's party, was formed in the 1980s, a classic left-wing socialist, but not communist party. It gained popularity because of its moderate socialist platform, which evolved into something more akin to Europe's social democrats. Currently there are parties to the left of PT and to the right. Calling it a centrist left party would be most accurate. PT has ushered in a series of economic and social reforms that have provided substantial government benefits and opportunities, which have lifted millions of Brazilians out of poverty. That said, they have also bought into the austerity dogma and have enacted draconian anti-terrorism laws as well, not all peaches and cream. PT rose to power in 2002 on when its charismatic leader, Lula da Silva, won the presidency. For the last 14 years the PT have held that post. Lula's ascendancy was a potent symbol of the empowerment of Brazil's poor under democracy, a laborer and union leader from a very poor family who dropped out of school in the second grade and was imprisoned by the dictatorship for union activities. He left office with such high approval ratings that he was able to ensure the election of his previously unknown hand-picked successor, Dilma, who was then re-elected in 2014. And now we return to present day. It has long been assumed that Lula, who vocally opposes austerity measures, intends to run again for president in 2018, and anti-PT forces, those of the 10%, are petrified that he'd again beat them at the ballot box. Though the nation's oligarchic classes have successfully used the center-right PSDB as a counterweight, it has been largely impotent in defeating PT in four consecutive presidential elections. Voting is compulsory, and the nation's poor citizens have ensured PT's victories. Now, as I said, corruption in Brazil is rampant. Think of it kind of like if you want a government service or help, you better be ready to tip the civil servant, and this goes all the way up the chain. When it happens there, it is called bribery. When it happens here in Canada or the US, it's a political contribution. Interesting. What makes this dangerous, at least to the Brazilian people, is that it seems the 10% and their media machine are exploiting this current round of investigations to accomplish via subversion what they could not do democratically, remove PT from power. Now, before some of my loyal listeners write in saying they are not all white or rich, which is true, and the poor of Brazil have complaints of their own, but like the Tea Party here, the ones controlling the movement, the vast majority of the supporters are those 10% heirs. Socio-economic disparities are so bad, I discovered a new term, social apartheid. Which is not imposed as directly as apartheid was in South Africa or is by Israel, but nonetheless, the 10% live in a very different world than the rest of Brazilians. Brazil's corporate media outlets are acting as de facto protest organizers and PR arms of opposition parties. Think Fox News and the Tea Party. Now imagine what those protests would have been if it had not been just Fox, but also ABC, NBC, CBS, Time Magazine, The New York Times, and The Huffington Post also supporting and inciting the Tea Party rallies. Summarizing, the business interests owned and represented by those media outlets are almost uniformly pro-impeachment and linked to the former military dictatorship and/or express sympathies for a new military takeover. And one side note, during a conversation I had with one of my co-workers, who by the way comes from Brazil and has family living there, stated she was very much in favor of removing PT and Dilma from power. I asked if she would support a military coup, and without hesitation said yes. That is what inspired my deep dive into this topic, and where this story may ultimately end. Indeed, much of the Brazilian right longs for restoration of the military dictatorship, and factions at these anti-corruption protests have been openly calling for the end of democracy. Let me pause again and remind people, this is not a defense of corruption, nor a denial of the fact that PT is unpopular with most groups right now. As I said, a culture of corruption, a downturn in the economy and megaprojects like the Olympics. That said, even though protesters are numbering in the millions, PT won the last election by 54 million votes just 2 years ago. In a democracy, governments are chosen by voting, not by displays of street opposition, particularly where, as in Brazil, the protests draw from a relatively narrow societal segment. On a side note, a photo of one of the protesting families went viral. Why? It showed a rich white couple decked out in anti-Dilma symbols and walking with their pedigree dog, trailed by their black weekend nanny, who was wearing the all-white uniform many rich Brazilians require their domestic servants to wear. The nanny, of course, was pushing a stroller with the rich couple's two children. One meme to emerge from this shot reads, "Speed it up there, Maria, we have to get out to protest against this government that made us pay you a minimum wage. Sometimes I just love the internet." Now, let me return to the fact corruption is very much alive and rampant in Brazil, but it is the rich that the anti-PT forces are using as their clarion call to impeach Dilma. Why? Five of the members of the impeachment commission are themselves being criminally investigated as part of the corruption scandal. One of the point men pushing for impeachment is himself facing an Interpol warrant and has been convicted in absentia to 3 years in prison in France for money laundering. Oh my, yes, and of the 65 members of the impeachment committee, 36 or about half are themselves facing pending legal procedures. The leader of the impeachment movement, Eduardo Cunha, is the target of multiple active criminal investigations. Senator Eceo Navas, the leader of the Brazilian opposition, has himself been implicated at least 5 separate times in the corruption scandal. The vice president, Michel Temer, of the opposition party PMDB, who would replace Dilma, has also been implicated in the corruption scandal. The pots are calling the kettle black, if you ask me. Judge Morrow, the overseer of the corruption investigation, has become somewhat of a folk hero for commendable aggressive investigations of some of the country's richest and most powerful figures. That said, this judge released over 50 recorded conversations, some illegally obtained, without any pretext of due process, and seemingly for political and not judicial aims. Needless to say, the oligarchic media has used these as a political bludgeon and to incite more riots. To be fair, the planned promotion of Lula to a cabinet position seems to be a favor to a mentor. As I said, Brazil is a very corrupt country. That said, Gerald Ford was not impeached for his amnesty for Nixon. In fact, that was worse. Lula could still be tried in Brazil's Supreme Court, just saying. And although everyone is talking about bribes at Petrobras, Lula is not part of the Petrobras bribery investigation that are the headline news, but asserts he owns more property than he claims, a small distinction maybe, but again points to the fact that the opposition are not really concerned with corruption but simply removing PT from power. And we return to what is likely the real purpose of all this high-minded activity, that being it's not anti-corruption that is driving it but rather an anti-democratic political weapon wielded by political opponents to remove a democratically elected president. To do anti-democratically what they cannot do democratically, and the irony is, those very people waving the flag of anti-corruption are themselves knee-deep in corruption, Brazil's culture of corruption. In other words, it all seems historically familiar, particularly for Latin America, where democratically elected left-leaning pro-lower class governments have been repeatedly removed by non-democratic, extra-legal means. My fear is that this will at best set a precedent in Brazilian politics, leading to a very unstable political environment, and at worst, it will end in a military coup that will end the democratic experiment in Brazil for who knows how long or how repressive, only time will tell. That said, it does raise some interesting questions. Should you stick with democracy when it seems to have failed? What happens when the voters get it horribly wrong? And yes, I am thinking of Donald Trump. We will be back after this break with a little commentary on Brazil's crisis and the just and unjust use of a coup d'etat.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
So, now we come to the next phase. And do we want to do the next phase?
Opinion time.
Do you stick with a democracy when it seems to have failed, right? I mean, at a certain point, do you sit there and you say, listen, like in the United States right now, one could make the argument that American democracy has failed. They no longer, I mean, they have the trappings of a democracy, but it no longer represents the people. So should you continue to support, and I'll use scare quotes here, a faux democracy?
Yeah, so, and that's the tough thing here. And what kind of transition in democracy do you use, right? I think, just in context here, Don, the person you work with, why is she in such support for, why are they in such support of a military coup?
Well, from my conversations with them, it's just the basic idea that the government is so corrupt that it needs to be gotten rid of, that there's no longer faith that the government can do what it's supposed to do because of this corruption scandal, that they should be gotten rid of. And when you couple that with the, and again, I don't know if we talked about this directly at the time I talked about the coup, but in follow-up conversations this was brought up, is that everyone is corrupt, that even if you got rid of Delma, you wouldn't solve the problem of corruption because, as we've said, everyone is corrupt.
Right.
And the only way to solve the root problem, corruption, is the military dictatorship.
Is it? Is a military dictatorship any more or any less, in this case, corrupt? I mean, there's no saying, like, there's no way that this can be 100% guaranteed in transition, right? To me, prior to the last, how many years have they been in decline here? Four years? Whatever. Since they've been going in this recession, their last couple of years have been horrible. But before that, they were doing incredibly well. So this party, one of the reasons it was liked so much is because of how well they've done for the country, how many, as was mentioned,
And why it's still electorally successful is, even in the face of all this, most Brazilians acknowledge that it's because of the PT party that their lives are better, even if the PT party in and of itself is not perfect.
Right. And I mean, Don, who of us isn't perfect? I know I've taken coffee bribes from customers before. But I think it's a systemic issue in a country, right? Now, I did a degree, surprise, surprise, but we studied international business. And this is something that was brought up in the class, was the corruption and bribery in places like Brazil and other Latin American countries, places like China, that happens a lot there as well, or favors more in China than anything else. But either way, you're saying get rid of a root problem here, Don, but I disagree. This is getting rid of a trunk. The root problem is much, much deeper than that. So, sure, it's a wiping of a facade here, because if you get rid of these corrupt people, I mean, the type of people that are going in, and because of the companies they work with, that's where you're getting these problems. So for me, it's more of just stricter. And I've always, this is just something across the board, I'm just much more for a stricter laws in terms of if something does go wrong. So military coup, no. But I think that these people should be tried and should be kicked out of the political parties.
I think, too, to reinforce your comments and to add a bit of space between my friend's comments and my own, the idea of a military coup would solve this was their opinion. I agree with you, because from historical context, the dictatorship was just as corrupt as before. It was just safer to be corrupt because you knew you weren't ever going to get arrested, because the dictatorship wouldn't let that happen. So I agree that it wouldn't solve the root problem. But it is sad that the situation is such that people perceive that it is. In the same way, and to go back to
just one thing. In terms of perception, this is exactly what we're talking about with the media, right? So you can't blame the person for what they're seeing. You know, people like us, we dig into these issues, but not everybody does. So anyway, continue.
That's a fair point, and I don't blame the person for thinking this, but I think there is a level of frustration, and we see this in the United States, where it seems like the system is so broken that even if it seems crazy, the other option, again, no matter how crazy, seems like the only rational choice. In the United States, Trump right now has basically taken on the mantle of, listen, trust me, I'll solve all your problems. I know what I'm saying, how I'm acting, doesn't lead you to believe that I can do it, but trust me, because look, the system here is so screwed up, you need someone like me who will solve all your problems. And because people are so frustrated, they want to buy into that illusion, because they're so frustrated, because the system is so screwed up that any option, no matter how irrational, seems like the best case scenario. And I think that's at the root of their saying, well, yes, let's go for a military coup, because any other option seems so crazy, so unworkable, so it wouldn't solve the problem. And even if they know in the back of their head that it might not really solve it, it's a straw that people grasp onto.
Yeah. Sorry, just one thing here. As you were talking, I'm just thinking in my head. Oh, yeah, I build the best systems. Everybody likes my systems. I've always built the best systems. Trust me, I make the best systems.
I'm a great negotiator. I'll negotiate the hell out of them.
Yeah, exactly. I'll get Brazil to pay for the corruption problems. I completely agree. And knowing I also know this person, and I feel for this person, you know, going through that and being closer to that, I can understand, like what you're saying. I know, as you were saying, it seems crazy to go potentially for a crazy option. But when your emotions are added into this, when it is actually happening to you and you need things to actually change, I can see why this person is making that call, right? So
I think I would add one more caveat, and we'll switch maybe the tone of the conversation a little bit, is I should put out a heavy asterisk here that we could be doing a lot of Canadian-splaining, if that's the word, white-splaining. I mean, to be fair, my friend is from Brazil. Far be it for me to actually come out and say, oh yeah, I know you're from there, but I know your problems better than you do. And I mean, to be fair, this segment has kind of been like that. And I only dare to do that because I have done a fair bit of research into this, that your average person on the street, and I think my friend would qualify as an average person on the street, might not have done. That being said, yes, take this all with a heavy grain of salt, especially if you're someone in the know in Brazil. So,
yeah, just
that be said.
We would hand out massive salt licks if we could. But
now, Matt, that goes down now to the root question, the philosophical question, the pearl in this mushy mess that is an oyster.
The mushy clam, yeah.
So what if Donald Trump becomes president of the United States?
Oh, yes, what it circles if, back to Trump.
What if in the last election, against everything that we know the people felt, somehow, who knows how, Harper was reelected? At that point, it would seem to me that I am no longer supporting a democracy in the sense that I think of a democracy.
Right.
Would at that point, would it be fair in, let's say, a Canadian context, so you don't have this history of evil dictatorships, but in the Canadian context, would it then be right for the Canadian military to step in and say, listen, we think this election was rigged. We are doing a War Measures Act, and let's pretend the Governor General supported this. Would you support a coup in that context?
And you had to bring up one of my most hated things. And yeah, so, I mean, let's go. Yeah, I think I would. There would be a lot of discussion, obviously, and obviously there has here. But I think coup is a strong word, right? There's a lot behind that. So I would say coup is probably too strong here. Does there need to be a military presence whilst a transition happens or something along those lines? Yes, I can definitely feel that in support. But again, coup, dang, that's a strong word, right? So, because, I don't know. In my mind, there is no perfect solution. Or, like, in my mind, there's a perfect solution, but it's Matt's perfect solution, right?
So, let's go then. I think just to answer the question that I posed, and for you, I think one of the things that would be such a difficult thing is in places like Brazil and Turkey comes to mind, other places, you have a military complex, for lack of a better word, that is an independent sort of power unto itself. Mm-hmm. So that you could have the head of the army step in and become prime minister
right.
and have his generals take cabinet posts.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be the same kind of hierarchy or independence for that to happen in Canada, which I guess is a good thing.
Yeah.
But then let's go with the other thing. What other kind of coup, to use the C word, I know you don't like the word coup, but let's go with that. What other kind of coup do you think we could do?
I think they're on the right track here, right? The investigatory board, like that's it's a the right way to do it. I think because, I mean, honestly, if there weren't that many people on the board that were under investigation, let them have it, right? But that, like, the systemic issue, like we're like the corruption is literally everywhere. Like you everywhere you look, all the companies, all the people. Like I think there, what was $100 million was one of the guys was yeah. one of anyway. Yeah, so I was right here. $100 million for one bribe. Like, anyway, sorry, I digress here.
Well, no, and actually, so you're basically proposing, and I think I would agree with you to a degree, of a judicial coup.
A judicial coup, that is, thank you, Donald, thank you, yeah.
And I think that also leads into one other thing that I left kind of fuzzy. I mentioned before that they had the investigation into Lulu's being mounted by one particular judge who's sort of seen, was it Judge Morrow? Who was seen as sort of a Cape Crusader in Brazil, and that he released, you know, these tapes that have been perceived as being a political act. And I think they were, but not a political act in the sense that he was trying to support the opposition. But it was the only tool he had left in his arsenal to basically say, listen, no one is above the law. You're trying to sidestep this investigation. And the only tool I have left in my repertoire is to release these tapes. And even though it will support the opposition, which I may or may not care about, it will hurt you. And that is what I need to do. I need to make sure that you know that you can't feck with the judiciary. And if you try to, we have our own ways to make you suffer for it.
Yeah, so we're saying here that it's a political step, but what if it's just a cry, right? Like, what if this is just, hey, everybody needs to see this, everybody needs to know, like, it's just a way to capture more of this corruption and to show how much there is. Obviously everybody knows now, but like,
well,
that's
even just something. If you're gonna play dirty, I can play dirty.
Exactly. You want to play it that way, let's play it that way. Yes, Donald, that's a perfect way of putting it. A judiciary coup. I accept the C word in that circumstance. And I think if it's done correctly, that can be the best measure.
So let's end this segment with something that I know Matt probably has no opinion on, but we'll throw
it. Is that such a thing? Do I never have an opinion?
I'm sure you must have no opinion on something.
All right, let's find out.
What happens, speaking of coups, Donald Trump, the guy you love the most in the United States, wins the vast majority of delegates in the Republican primaries. But he's one vote short of an absolute majority. And somehow he does not become the nominee for the Republican Party. Hey, that would be a good thing, but that's a side point. Is that a political coup?
Well, I have no opinion on the matter, so let's continue.
Well, so let me add another context to this then, because one of the things that has come up very much in the Republican campaign, and for people who want to support Bernie Sanders in the Democratic campaign are hoping and praying for, is what they call a brokered convention. The idea of a brokered convention is no delegate has actually won an absolute majority. Therefore, it's going to come down to the convention. And at the convention, people are going to, you know, trade favors, and they're going to try and convince you to support him or the other person. And in which case, the person who comes in with the most delegates may not, and has in historical precedent, not necessarily won the party nomination. I do believe Truman was the Democratic nominee in 1940-something, when the person going in there was a gentleman named Sargent, who was a very good person, but historically he's lost now because in a brokered convention, even though he had the most delegates, the party apparatus didn't want him to win, so he didn't win. So in that context of a brokered convention, Donald Trump has himself threatened that there would be riots in the street if he did not get the nomination, because he obviously is the most popular choice of the Republicans. Do you think a political coup by the Republican establishment to prevent Donald Trump from becoming their nominee is any worse than a military coup that we've been talking about?
I mean, I would prefer judicial coup. But yeah, okay. So, yes. Hey, surprise, I have an opinion. No, I believe there's steps, right? There are steps of coups. Let's break down this word here. So political coup, right? So we're stepping in a semi-democratic way, right? Because, I mean, people are coming to an agreement, like the Conservative Party here, right, that we're talking about. They're coming to an agreement that they don't want this man.
Republican Party.
Sorry. Oh, God. You were talking about Harper earlier. Got me going. They're it's essentially a democratic coup, right? Because there's a group of people who've come together who have decided to remove a figure, almost like a vote of no confidence, right? So I would say that's a low-level coup if we're doing this kind of thing, right? So what I'm proposing in Brazil is the judiciary coup, so getting a much stronger presence to investigate and remove people who have been involved, and also charge the companies that have also been involved, right? So you have Petrobras, you've got, there's a huge construction company that's been instrumental in these kinds of things. So that's another thing. So, and then if none of this works, you have a military coup in which the military, designed to protect the country and the people, has to step in and facilitate a peaceful transition into a new election, right? So I would say, in my mind, those are Matt's level of coups.
And on that note, we've come to the end of the show. Matt, say goodbye.
Goodbye, folks. And remember to stay open, stay happy, stay healthy.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.